That hymn taken from Tennyson are beautiful and memorable and remind us of the fact that we are going to someday cross the bar and we will meet the pilot face to face. Appreciate being able to be with you this evening, and I want to share with you tonight a study from the fourth chapter of Paul's remarkable letter to the Philippians. We'll begin our reading with verse 4, and we will read through verse 9. Philippians 4, verses 4 through 9. Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of a good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you. I suspect that people, having known me for some time, expect me to give my annual anti-Christmas sermon. I've talked about the religious observation of the birth of Christ, which the Bible does not teach. And I think that Bible principles forbid. I've talked about that in the bulletin. And I'm not going to preach on that tonight. But you know, sometimes when you try to teach one thing, you end up with people thinking something else. It's almost impossible to escape misunderstanding sometimes, and if you're not careful, all the time. It's very difficult for people to understand the difference between the observation of a national holiday, which deeply stirs all of us, a family gathering circumstance, when people turn back in their minds and their memories to childhood, when people exchange gifts and do things like that. And it's very difficult for people to make a difference in their thinking between doing that and the observance of a holiday religiously. That is, acting as if what they were doing in commemorating the birth of Christ is something that the Bible teaches us to do. It does not, and in fact it teaches us that we do not observe anything of that nature unless God clearly tells us to. Jesus said in initiating this whole thing that we call the religion of Christ, he said that we're to go and teach people, in fact all nations, and we're to baptize them into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. We're to teach them, that is the baptized ones, the things that he's commanded. We could multiply passages to support the conclusion tonight that we simply do not, of our own wisdom, institute and practice things in religion. But just as I'm mindful that we do not celebrate the birthday of Christ with divine approval, I'm also aware that we do enjoy as individuals, and under individual liberty, we enjoy a great deal the holiday, the Christmas holiday. And no one could deny that a lot of things that we enjoy in the holiday reflects things that have spiritual implications. For instance, a love of family, it's a Bible teaching. Also, an appreciation of what it is to give and to receive. I think when we're very young, receiving is real good. It's a lot of fun. And as we get older, we realize the real fun in life is giving. And that very progression from childhood to adulthood is an indication of spiritual maturity. Yet it cannot be denied that sometimes it's the little ones who teach us more than any other group of people the significance of the love of giving. To want to go back and to go home, the want of sharing times with those that we love very dear, these all have within them things that have clear spiritual implications. And in reality, the great praise that I would heap upon the holiday, the Christmas holiday, is that it causes us to think about some things that are the best things that we can think about. Now, that's kind of a lengthy introduction to a sermon in which I'm going to try to tell you something about how to think on other things. You know, when you preach a sermon, you do some research. You're supposed to. Now, some cynics have the idea that what preachers do is they think for 10 or 15 minutes, and then they take about 30 minutes and 40 minutes of words and dilute those 10 minutes of thinking, and they have what they call a sermon. But you do research. And I'm impressed with a statement that a Russian scientist, whose name, his first name is Albert and his last one, I believe if I said it, I could not continue with my lesson tonight. But he said, research is to see what everybody else has seen and think what no one else has thought. Now, I'm not so foolish as to think that I'm going to, as a result of looking at something that all of you've looked at, come up with something perhaps you've never thought, but the hope of every sermon is that maybe we can cause somebody in the audience to think about some things that maybe they have not thought about before. Another thing about research that's interesting, Charles Kettering said that research is an organized method of keeping you reasonably dissatisfied with what you have. I think that's the purpose of preaching. We're supposed to, in an organized way, keep you reasonably dissatisfied with what you are as Christians, so you'll strive for that which is better. Now, the worst kind of preaching or research you can do may be under what they call basic research. You know what that is? That's when a scientist is doing what he doesn't know what he's doing. Now, I hope I know what I'm doing tonight, as I will try to share with you some things from Paul's great statement in the fourth chapter of the book of Philippians, because it talks about how we ought to be developing the capacity to think about certain things. I said that the holidays that help us to think about family, help us to think about childhood that was good and influence us for good. Thinking about giving and receiving, those kind of things will do us good. And I think if we'll contemplate the things that Paul tells us we ought to be thinking about in the fourth chapter, it'll do us good too. The epistle to the Philippians is the most personal of all Paul's letters. I think that's undeniable. And when you get a hold of this epistle and it gets a hold of you, you find yourself wrapped up in something, as F.W. Farrar says, that is written to the church in which he felt the most at home and whose members he loved most tenderly. It's a remarkable thing about what Paul says about this church. It's interesting to me that one of the most surprising qualities about the epistle is the joy that's there. Paul is under difficult circumstances, but most of us who've read this epistle know that it just radiates with joy, and even the reading tonight had that very idea, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice in the fourth verse of the fourth chapter. 13 times the noun joy or the verb to rejoice are found in this epistle, scattered all through it. It just radiates with that. Some observations about the reading that we had tonight very quickly. First of all, the point about rejoicing. Joy is a quality that I think all of us really want. We may have difficulty getting a hold of it, but once we've known it, we want it, and we want it again. And one of the things about the holidays is that it makes us think about when we were children. At least these things are coming out of me, how I feel about it. And I can remember the excitement and the expectation and the sheer joy that I like to go back to and think about when I find so many things that seem to push joy away. Secondly, let it be noted that he says, after talking about rejoicing, that let your moderation, and really the other translations have caught the force of this, your forbearance, your gentleness, or someone might translate it, your sweet reasonableness. Christians have got to learn, and I'm still learning, that the great treasure of sweet reasonableness, moderation, forbearance, not letting everything that comes up knock us off our blocks, to keep a stability, to be able to have the quality of patience. Patience is that quality that does not surrender to circumstances or succumb under trial. It is the very opposite of despondency. It is to be equated with hope. And so he says, rejoice and let this forbearance be known unto all men. Something that ought to be known about us who meet over in this place is our joy and our forbearance. And then he says something very quickly and simply, very shortly. The Lord is near. Now you, when you read what those who've studied this and commentators want to say about this, they say it's possible to think about this in the sense that the coming of Christ is always a thing that's near to people, in the sense that he could be coming this very day. But perhaps even more so the idea is that the Lord is near, in the sense that he's not far from any of us. And that's a good thing to keep in mind. And so he says, don't worry. Be careful for nothing. If probably we could put in a bottle the worry that's in this room tonight, we'd probably have to admit that it reflects badly upon the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. I know you may say, speak for yourself, John, but I suspect that your experience in rubbing elbows and meeting and commenting with people would underscore the truth of that. But in nothing be anxious, he says, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. Prayer is a general term, but supplication appears to be specifically dealing with things for which we beg God's care and concern in his response. And sometimes people make distinctions which have no differences in the Bible, but at least that perhaps is one that we have there. And then he talks about the peace which passeth understanding shall keep your hearts. Then he moves into what I really was caused to prepare this lesson for, because as I said, in tribute to the holidays in which some good things come over us, some good things that we think about, I want you to see the exhortation here of Paul as he tells us how to handle this whole thing. He says, finally, brethren. Now, Paul said finally earlier, so he wasn't done. Someone says that, like preachers, they say finally and they don't really mean it. But he was really saying there's some more here that I cannot close until I say this to you. This is important and this is vital. And as you look at this, which I'm telling you, you put this in here because it's essential. What he tells us is what we're to think about, and then he tells us what we're to do. Verse 8 is talking about thinking, but verse 9, those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. This is a passage which just is bristling with the concept of apostolic example. In other words, the apostles on earth, by their teaching, by what they said and by what they did, they left examples for people to follow. And so one of the most important things that we have in Bible study is to search for apostolic examples, to see what the apostles, under the evident, obvious, indisputable approval of Jesus Christ, said and did for our imitation. Now, he says about the things that we're to think about, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise. And that's a general summary about these things that he lists. The word virtue there can be translated and is in some translations excellent. If there is anything that is excellent, notice in verse 10 of the first chapter, chapter 1 and verse 10, he says that you may approve the things that are excellent, and that you may be sincere and without offense until the day of Christ. The word here, when he talks about excellent, is diaphero. It's an original term here, or in the term in the original Greek, which means the things that differ. Christians have got to be making differences when people do not have the capacity to see that this right here is obviously much better than that. They have failed. We must be a people who are approving the things that are excellent, the things that really are different. Everything isn't the same. And Christians have to develop that. Now, the word that's used here, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, the word virtue in this text is arete. And it has to do with excellence, a striving, a spirit, an attitude of heart to try to achieve the very best. And so he tells us to think about the very best things. If there be any virtue, if there be anything that has the quality of excellence about it, think about it. Our minds were made by God, and they can be used and abused by man with many things. They really honor God, though, when they're used for the purpose of thinking about the best things that ultimately honor us as people who say that we love our Creator and appreciate what He has done for us. The word arete is defined in things like Vine's word study as whatever procures preeminent estimation for a person or thing. It procures preeminent estimation. It says this is the very best thing. And you know, the reason why people, I think generally in the population, like things about Christmas. Now some people just hate it, you know, but like the Christmas holidays, is because at least for a little while people are bent upon thinking about things. Now some people justify the Christmas tradition, the religious tradition, because, well, at least people are thinking about Christ. And someone says, well, isn't that good? Well, obviously I'd have to be a calloused fool if I didn't appreciate people's thinking and honoring Christ. But greater wisdom understands that we don't honor Christ in the way we want to. The higher wisdom would be to recognize that we honor Him in the way that He wants us to. But at least people who are caught up in the fervor of thinking about good things for a while, even though they say, well, it's not possible for such a good life to exist, at least for a while they enjoy it, even if they know they're going to come back down to earth, as they would say. The other expression that he uses, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, if you find that which is praiseworthy. Now, most of us know that the person who has no discrimination, anything they say, that looks pretty, that looks great. As Samuel Johnson said, he who praises everybody praises nobody. If you praise everything, you don't praise anything. In other words, the ability to look at something and say, that's beautiful. Now, someone goes in a museum and everything they see, oh, that's beautiful, that's wonderful, and pretty soon now, you may understand that they don't have the capacity to make distinctions. Christians are, of course, then to be able, as the text in the first chapter, verse 10 says, that we are to discriminate the things that differ from one another. I read many things from people, and one fellow I read, Osbert Sitwell, he said that if I were rich, I would hire a professional praiser. He's going around praising. Well, we kind of do that, don't we? We've got PR men all over the country. But there are things that are worthy of praise. I get a little wearied myself with the Howard Cosells of the world, who they just tell you about everything is fantastic and wonderful and all that, you know. First of all, I get a little wearied with someone telling me what I saw, you know. But I get a little worried with someone that makes no difference, no discrimination. But what Paul says is there, if there is that which is excellent, if there is that which is praiseworthy, then think about those things. We need more praise for that which is good. I'll tell you, this evil gets a lot of publicity. I saw something in a paper today where the actor Burt Reynolds was saying the trouble with him is that he gets bad scripts and bad press. That's why he just can't do any better than he's doing. Well, I tell you one thing, evil gets a mighty big press. Good is not praised as much as it ought to be. And if it ought to be praised coming from the mouth of any people, it ought to be from Christians. And someone said about encouragement, we all need it, encouragement is like premium gasoline. It takes the hard knocks out of living. Now, I had a little surprise, and it happened to me. I was showing it to Les a while ago. And Ruth went in back. There's a little card on my desk, and I opened it up, and this was a card of appreciation. And what it was is a thank you card from a couple that I married or performed their ceremony a year ago, and they were thanking me for it. Now, I'll be waiting for the next year and see if I get one then. But that's the kind of thing that's encouraging, you know. I'll tell you what's discouraging around this time of year, and I've had this over the years. I haven't had it yet here. But you get a card, you open it up, and I like to get cards. I like to get mail. Open it up, and there's this big, beautiful card, and on the front it has some men on camels, and there's a big star up the top. And it says, to our beloved pastor at this holy season, Merry Christmas. And I get a little weary. Back to the old drawing board. What I'm trying to say is that the Apostle Paul is counseling us here to think about the things that are excellent, the things that are praiseworthy. And he tells us some of these things. And if you enjoy your holiday, and I hope you do, in the time that you have with one another, and there are implications, there are spiritual implications in all that we do, but check to see if the things that stir within you, the best things, do not have their root in an appreciation of the kind of things that Paul is talking about here. Let's look at some of these things together. He says, whatsoever things are true. We live in a world of deception, and it does us all good to think about the things that are true. I remember the famous dissident, Soviet dissident, Solzhenitsyn, who came to this country. He's lifted his voice, raising his voice in warning, telling us about the realities of the 20th century. And in one of his speeches, he said, the truth is not hard to see. You can see it at a glance. The only trouble is that error is so much more comfortable. We need to spend time thinking about things that are true, that we know are true. Truth, certainly, is excellent, and it's praiseworthy. And if it is, then let's spend time thinking about it. But let me note that after he talks about thinking in verse 8 in Philippians chapter 4 in verse 9, he says, do something about it. Think with me about some things that are true. We need to realize the value of the soul. That's a truth. For what is a man profit if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for a soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of the Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. Matthew 16, 26 and 27. We need to think about that fact. The soul cost Christ's life. He came in this world and died for our souls that they might be saved. He emptied himself of himself. That's exactly what it tells us in Philippians chapter 2. We need to think about the truth that we live in the presence of God. That's a solemn and a helpful truth. We need to think about that. In Psalm 139, verses 7 through 10, the psalmist said, whither shall I flee from thy spirit? And he causes his eyes to go heavenward and into the depths and everywhere he could imagine, and he cannot see himself out of the presence of God. We can't hide from him. And since that's a truth, then in his presence, if we love him and respect him, that truth, having been thought about soberly, will have an effect upon us. We need to realize that we must stand in Christ's presence at the judgment day. We need to think about that truth. The Bible teaches in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the things done in the body. There are some things that we can evade in this life, but you're not going to evade the judgment. The rich and the poor, the small and the great, the educated and the uneducated, the weak and the powerful, the popular and the unpopular, there's not a human being that is not going to face the judgment. And we need to think about that truth. I'll never forget reading after a great man who said, what was the most single, significant, and solemn thought that ever entered his mind? And he said this, that I'm going to stand in the presence of God someday. in judgment. We need to realize that death is sure, and this life that we live is uncertain. Now, that's a truth. And you know, I believe that one of the most difficult things that I see as a preacher is to keep my own heart in tune to that truth, to recognize, John, you're not going to get maybe another opportunity, and that death is coming. We need to realize the truth of what the Bible says about what it means to be lost. Now, the Bible doesn't fool with this thing. It doesn't portray, on the one hand, the beautiful picture of heaven and then leave us guessing as to the horrors of hell. The Bible is so vivid on this that no person who's thinking straight, if they believed the Bible to be the Word of God and took this stuff seriously, would ever want to contemplate the idea that I would have to endure an eternity of that. And we need to realize the truth that the Lord saves only the good and the faithful among those who commit themselves unto Him when they obey the gospel. That's a truth we got to keep reminding ourselves of. And if that thing is worthy, if it's praiseworthy and it's excellent, we need to think about it. He said, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest. It's interesting that the word honest comes into the English language from a Latin word, honos, which means honor. And that's why you see in some of the translations that you'll have that very idea of worthy of respect. Whatever is worthy of respect, what is august and venerable. Matthew Arnold said the meaning of this word is nobly serious. The New International Version has translated it, what's noble. Whatever thing is true and whatever thing is noble, something that's worthy of respect. It says in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts in verse 11 that the Bereans were more noble than those in Thessalonica. Now let's think about their nobility. What made them that way? We need to think about things that are noble. It's good to see people who could be called noble, worthy of respect. It says that with readiness of mind they received the teaching that the apostles gave, and they searched the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. It's a sign of nobility, of a person who's willing to listen and then willing to examine for themselves. God honors that, and we ought to honor that too. There are movies that have left a deep imprint upon our lives. We cannot deny the imprint of books, of drama, of television, of the movies. And one of the movies that I loved when I first saw it was To Kill a Mockingbird. It was the story about how a man that was a lawyer in a southern town, in one summer, he grew from just a father to a moral giant in the eyes of his children. And there's a scene in that movie in which he's been making a noble effort to defend a black man who's been charged falsely with a crime. There's a lot of deep feeling about that trial in that southern city. And as he picks up his books and papers and puts them in his little satchel and he starts to make his way out of the courtroom, the balcony that has been reserved for the blacks, all of them stand as this lawyer striding out in his white suit on that hot day. They all stand, and the children are wondering and ask about it. And there's an old man who says, they're standing out of honor to your father. He's a real man. Respect him. We need to think about things that are noble. If the noble acts of decent people got the same press coverage, I think that people would get an idea that there's something more to this life than the things that make it a pain to contemplate. Whatsoever things are just, and the New International Version renders it right. You know, we have a lot of discussion among people sometimes, and they get into discussions of moral issues, and we have pro and con and back and forth. And yet, when we come to the Bible, there's sort of a simplicity and directness and brevity with which the Bible addresses certain things. Listen to Paul now in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Long, lengthy philosophical discussion? No, ma'am. No, sir. This is right. I appreciate the person who has enough sense, has enough strength of character, when they see something that's wrong, to clearly see that it is wrong. And no matter how you try to paint it and portray it, it's wrong. And it seems to me that that quality is developed from the standpoint of thinking about that which is right. An ancient Greek stood up amongst his people in Athens and said that justice would never come to Athens until the injustice that every other citizen in Athens suffers pains you as much as injustice to yourself does. We've got to think about right. In Proverbs 23, verse 22, hearken unto thy father that begat thee, and despise not thy mother when she is old. We're talking about, as Paul said, it's right to respect your parents. It's right. And there's no way to make disrespect for parents right. In Colossians 3:23, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Now, when you put those two verses together, they're parallel passages. To obey your parents is right. This is well-pleasing to the Lord. There is no way for us to please the Lord and call what's wrong right. It won't go. In Psalm 119, verse 128, the psalmist is extolling his love of God's law. And he says, therefore I esteem all thy precepts concerning all things to be right, and I hate every false way. Whatever God says on everything is right. People who enter the kingdom with the idea, well, if I come across something I don't particularly like, I'll just walk around that and sidestep that. And I think that probably all of us who've tried to make this spiritual journey as far as we have found ourselves in a struggle between what we think and what we want and what we determine to be good and right and what God has said. And you know, one of the safest ways to never have to change is never study your Bible. I had a little bit of thing here about that I want to share with you about our children and about studying. Someone wrote this. This is not the greatest poetry in the world, but it has a point. Mary had a little boy. His soul was white as snow. He never went to Bible class because Mary wouldn't go. He never heard the stories of Christ that thrilled the childish mind while other children went to class. This child was left behind. And as he grew from babe to youth, she saw to her dismay. A soul that once was snowy white became a dingy gray. Realizing he was lost, she tried to win him back, but now the soul that once was white had turned an ugly black. She even started back to church and Bible study too and begged the preacher, isn't there a thing that you can do? The preacher tried and failed and said, we're just too far behind. I tried to tell you years ago, but you would pay no mind. And so another soul is lost once, white as snow. Bible study would have helped, but Mary wouldn't go. We hope to develop character and a sense of right and wrong without study, without learning what God's book teaches. How are we going to learn what's right? Whatsoever things are true, and whatsoever things are noble, and whatsoever things are right, whatsoever things are pure. Remember the soap that used to advertise 99 and 44, 100% pure? Pure what? It was a nice slogan. The word pure comes from the Greek word hagnos, and it's from the same family of words as hagios, which is the word translated holy. And what it means, pure from defilement, not contaminated. It means unmixed. A thing is not pure if it has mixed together that which is supposed to be and then something else. If you'll note in the first chapter of Philippians, he talks about the things that he wants them to be, and he says that you may approve the things that are excellent and that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ. And the word sincere there is from the Latin expression sine care, mean without wax. But the Greek word here has the idea of that which is unadulterated. It is unmixed. It's the real. It's not part of this and part of that. The Greek word has the idea of unalloyed. It's pure and it's unmixed. We need to think about things that are pure. James says, in talking about this life that we live and either being directed by that which comes from above or that which comes from beneath, he says, the wisdom that cometh from above is first of all pure and then it's peaceable. What he means is it is unmixed. The wisdom that comes from above is unmixed with human wisdom, because you simply can't make it from the standpoint of determining that where I agree with God, I'll go with him, and where I don't, I'll go another way. And the interesting thing is that as we prize peace, and we ought to, the Bible does, it puts purity in front of peace. Because there can be no peace among the people of God, the kind of peace that's worth anything, until there is that unadulterated, unmixed devotion to what God has said. Because if you get people who desire the wisdom that comes from above more than any other thing, they have then a basis for peace and unity. But there is not any basis for peace and unity when we have a mixed loyalty. The only hope of taking people of such disparaging backgrounds and differences and cultures and making them one is Jesus Christ. That's the only hope. So whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are noble, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure. And then he says, whatsoever things are lovely. I saw something lovely yesterday. Oh, I saw a lot of things lovely, but I saw something particularly lovely. And not in the circumstances that we think about are lovely. Ruth and I went over to the hospital, and we went to see Mary Free, and she was sitting there, and the sun was streaming in a window, and I looked at a careworn face. I could see that she had been waiting for hours. She wasn't in that kind of appearance that you would like if you're going out to do something to be at your very best. I could tell that she was like many people are when they're waiting in the waiting room of an intensive care section of a hospital. And yet I saw a beautiful sight. She was a beautiful sight to me. A concerned, waiting, loving person. Doing what they could do. The word lovely here, it's composed of that word phileo, a word for love, and then pros. Pros phileo. It has the idea of pleasing and agreeable and lovely. As Chesterton said, the way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. I think I've told you before about the Mona Lisa was stolen from the Louvre in Paris. It was gone for a couple of years. There's a blank spot on the wall. And those who keep these kind of records say that more people came and looked at the blank spot on the wall than had ever been to visit the Mona Lisa before. And I suspect that you might make some kind of an argument that the fact that this was so valuable and now the treasure was gone and there was that long lingering look at something that was so wonderful and now it's gone. Why do we have to wait until the lovely people and the lovely things of this life are gone and then we, with longing look, wish they were still there? Think about things that are lovely. And I think that's what makes us like to go home and scratch anybody. I don't care who they are, for what their rank and station is in life, and you'll find basically underneath that skin a human being that has the same sort of dreams and desires when they're at their best that others do. We need to think about things that are lovely. I want to share this with you. A woman wrote a tribute to her mother. She titled this Beauty. According to her height and weight on the insurance chart, she should be a guard for the Lakers. She has iron-starred blood. One shoulder is lower than the other, and she bites her fingernails. She's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. She should be. She's worked on that body and face for more than 60 years. The process for that kind of beauty can't be rushed. The wrinkles in her face have been earned one at a time. The stubborn one around the lips that deepen with every no. The thin ones on the forehead that mysteriously appeared when the first child was born. The eyes are protected by glass now, but you can still see the perma wrinkles around them. Young eyes are darting and fleeting. These are mature eyes that reflect a lifetime. Eyes that have glistened with pride, filled with tears of sorrow, snapped in anger, and burned from loss of sleep. They are now direct and penetrating and look at you when you speak. The bulges are classic. They develop slowly from babies too sleepy to walk, who had to be carried home from grandma's, grocery bags lugged from the cars. Ashes carried out of the basement while her husband was at war. Now they were fed by a minimum of activity, a full refrigerator and TV bins. The extra chin is custom grown and takes years to perfect. And sometimes you can only see it from the side, but it's there. Pampered women don't have an extra chin. They cream them away or pat the muscles until they become firm. But this chin has always been there, supporting a nodding head that has slept in a chair all night, bent over knitting, praying. The legs are still shapely, but the step is slower. They ran too often for the bus, stood a little too long when she clerked in the department store, got beat up while teaching her daughter how to ride a two-wheeler. They're purple at the back of the knees. The hands, they're small and veined and have been dunked and dipped and shook and patted and wrung and caught indoors, splintered, dyed, bitten, blistered. But you can't help but be impressed when you see the ring finger that has shrunk from years of wearing the same wedding ring. It takes time and much more time to diminish a finger. I looked at Mother long and hard the other day and said, Mom, I have never seen you so beautiful. And she responded, I ought to be, I work at it. Whatsoever things are true, and whatsoever things are noble, and whatsoever things are right, and whatsoever things are pure, and whatsoever things are lovely. And Paul ends it by saying, whatsoever things are of good report. The other translations render it admirable. It says of elders in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7 that they're to be of good report with those that are without. You see, goodness can't ultimately be hidden, certainly not from the eyes of God, but also from the eyes of those people who have a responsive chord in them that can be vibrated in the presence of something that's right and good. And so he speaks about how that we ought to think about these things. I don't know how you are, but I read the newspaper, and I know it's a cliche. It's been said so often that it's lost its force, but it's just true that the newspapers are generally filled with a whole lot of bad news. A part of being an editor of a newspaper this time of year is to scour the city and find as many human interest stories as you can. Things to stir people's hearts and make them feel good about the holiday season, and especially make them think about the good things that people do, which reflect human beings at their best. But there are stories to be told, lives to be viewed, character manifested it in such a way as to be admired. It's all around us. But I suspect that negative thinking and thinking about how bad and how difficult this world is a habit. And the only way to handle it is the way in which Paul talks specifically about how to handle worry. He says, empty your mind of it and then fill it with something that's better. In nothing be anxious. In other words, dump all that negative thinking. And then he says, but in everything by prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace that passeth understanding shall keep your hearts. I hope that all of you will have a good holiday, a good time with your families. Even if you're here and you're alone, in a sense, in other words, you're away from home, it will be even in that loneliness and the sadness of that that your hearts will be driven back to think about good times and good people. It seems to me that the whole thing that Christians have as a tremendous responsibility and opportunity is not to be seasonal in thinking such things, but in season and out of season, when others do it or do not do it, we need to be thinking good things. This is my lesson for tonight. Happy holidays to you.